The colorful John Bascom became the president of the University of Wisconsin in 1874, and he championed causes such as the education of women, temperance, labor, and the spread of what became known nationally as the Wisconsin Idea, the notion that the university should serve as a force for good for all the people of the state, not just a privileged elite. I'm Emily Auerbach. Joining me is David Hoveler, Professor Emeritus of History of the UW-Milwaukee, to explore his new book, John Bascom and the Origins of the Wisconsin Idea. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks so much.
Well, let's talk about, we're just a block away here in Madison from Bascom Hill, at the top of which sits Bascom Hall, the power seat of the campus. But what would draw you to write a book about John Bascom in particular?
John Bascom was an exciting project for me. In terms of my career in history and terms of the books I've written, I've had an interest in what we call intellectual history. That's my field. And intellectual history is really a focus on ideas and culture and their interaction with a larger environment, society, politics, religion, and so on. But also, some of the books I've written have dealt with higher education and the history of our colleges and universities, including the colonial colleges. So I had started Bascom as a project not long after I came to UW-Milwaukee in the early 1970s and did a short article for the Wisconsin Magazine of History. But it was in the back of my mind in the ensuing years to do a more expansive study of him. So I got further into the extensive record of his writings, and he wrote many books, theology, philosophy, sociology. But in terms of intellectual history, he's an ideal subject because he didn't rest there. He affected a system, really an intellectual system, that could carry over to the world of the Gilded Age in the late 19th century and use it to address what he saw as some very serious problems in American life and to use actually his presidency at this university almost as a bully pulpit for addressing an array of subjects from the rarefied realm of theology and philosophy but down to the reforms that you just mentioned in your introduction.
And if you were sitting next to someone on the plane from another state who had never heard of John Bascom, and they said, give me a one-sentence tagline on who this John Bascom guy is, how would you answer that?
John Bascom was a thinker of many wide interests and applications, and anxious to establish a very serious intellectual basis for what he did as a thinker.
Okay, and he served for quite a long time as president of the UW-Madison from 1874 to 1887.
Indeed.
I understand that, and we'll talk about it later, that he got in trouble a little bit with some of the legislators, which is nothing new in terms of the university politics. So we'll talk about that. But let's go back to his childhood. Can you kind of set the stage for what turned him into the kind of person that he became?
Sure. Let's take the long look very quickly. John Bascom came from a long line of Calvinists. All of his father, grandfather, going way back, were in the ministry, the Protestant ministry, mostly New England. But his ancestry even goes back to the Huguenots in France, who, of course, were under the thumb of the Bourbon monarchs and driven from France. Many found their way to England, became part of the Puritan Revolution against the Stuarts in the 17th century. And we find actually Bascom's in the early arrivals as early as the 1670s. This is true also of his wife, Laura Woodbridge. They have a deep-seated place in New England history. His father was a missionary for a while for the churches and found his way to central New York. And that is where Bascom was born in Genoa in 1828. He lost his father just about a year later, so he never knew his father. It was left to his mother to deal with some very hard economic circumstances.
Do you think the fact that he was raised by this strong mother and also had sisters, do you think that made a difference in terms of his later support of women's suffrage and women's education?
It did indeed. He was not close to his mother, and that gets us into another theme here, because although I stated that he came from a long line of Calvinists, he broke emphatically from that theological tradition. He found it harsh. He found it disabling of human initiative because of its determinism. But he saw in his mother the way it really warped her personality, dark, brooding, fearful, alienated from her son. It was his sisters, three wonderful sisters, that, well, gave him the encouragement he needed and even pooled their resources so that from this very poor farm family, he could still go to college. And he went to Williams, where his father had graduated in Massachusetts, and had 4 years there to launch his kind of intellectual life.
Did he major, was it in philosophy, theology, or some kind of...
He didn't have majors then, really.
Okay.
You took a pretty prescribed curriculum of Latin and Greek languages, moral, mental philosophy. He studied with Mark Hopkins, a very legendary president. And that really was the courses they took, all the students in their senior year with the college president. Mental philosophy and moral philosophy was kind of the crowning point of the curriculum designed to prepare you intellectually and as citizen as you left the university to engage the world.
You write in your book about his first wife dying and he married again, is that?
Yes.
And how did his family life have an impact on his views?
Emma Bascom was really a partner with John Bascom at the university and in the three causes I mentioned. Not so much the third, which was the question of money and capital and classes. But she was an ardent champion of women's rights. She was also very supportive of the temperance movement. We shouldn't be surprised. These movements went hand in hand. It may not seem so today. Temperance may not look progressive at all. But women championed it for a number of reasons. Bascom and Emma were both close to people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton in the larger movement in the United States. I think there's a symbolic note, too, that Bascom was born only 40 miles from Seneca Falls, which in 1848 was the site of a national meeting of women, the first national organization of women ever in American history, and really the foundation of the modern feminist movement.
Yeah, with their declaration of sentiments and
yes,
all
indeed.
Kinds of radical thinking.
Important document, yes.
So what did John Bascom do before coming to the University of Wisconsin, and why did he end up in Madison?
Oh, that's a nice question. He had an intellectual career well in place by the time he got here, so I'll try to summarize that. From Williams, he practiced law for a while. Didn't really like it. And he kept thinking about religious questions and reading theological treatises and so on. He decided, therefore, to go to theological seminary. And he chose the place, which is actually close to his family, Auburn Theological Seminary in Auburn, New York. It was Presbyterian. It was New School Presbyterian. Some of your our listeners may know that the Presbyterian Church split in the 1830s between the Calvinists and the more liberal, more socially progressive, more anti-slavery group, the New School. And Bascom was affiliated with that group. But he went there also to study with an important philosopher whom he had discovered and read and admired immensely. This was Lawrence Perseus Hickok. And it's also the reason why he stayed there only 1 year, because Hickok was recalled to his own alma mater, Union College, and left Auburn. So after a very brief interlude, Bascom decided to go back and study again in theological seminary, and this time went to Auburn Theological Seminary. This was a school near Harvard. It was formed when Harvard went Unitarian, which shocked New England because this is the end of the school of the old Calvinists. But it was a school that went progressively more liberal in its thinking as well. And he got there at a time when it was in that transition, And that part of his education really secured him in what I call in the book liberal Protestantism. It's a major component of his intellectual repertoire and part of his effort to situate himself outside of the Calvinist orthodoxy of the day. So to get him to Wisconsin, we need one more step.
I'm just curious, too. How is he paying the rent equivalent during this time? What is he actually earning money doing?
Nothing.
Nothing.
These schools were subsidized by the churches. He was almost blind and almost gave up even doing that. But he had earned a little bit of money as a lawyer. The details, I'm not sure, but it was not prohibitive. We're used to think of how it is today. Okay. Mark Hopkins, his former president, again called him back to Williams, first as a professor of rhetoric, and then for the 20 years before he came here, in that role, he embraced these early causes that he would champion more fully when he arrived to Madison.
The idea of women's education,
yes,
co-education,
yeah.
Suffrage.
Yeah. In fact, he was caught in a big issue at Williams. Some of the New England schools were going co-educational. One by one, it was not a mass movement. But there was an effort at Williams to get that school to make that commitment itself. Most opposed it, but the trustees decided that they would at least have an investigating committee and have a report. That report issued in the negative, three opposed, two in support. But John Bascom wrote a long defense of why Williams should go co-educational. I say in the book that this would not have surprised people who had followed him closely heretofore because it already entered into that question. He wrote a wonderful essay about the whole unhappy plight of females as he saw it in the United States, the disadvantages they faced, not just prejudice in terms of getting a higher education, but even the way they were forced to dress, the awkward, cumbersome, unutilitarian manner in which they were braced and buckled. He had a very sharp eye. On this issue, he was way ahead of his time, even more so than some of the feminist leaders of the day.
And so his idea of co-education at Williams failed.
It never got off got out of the gate.
And
Williams did not go co-educational until 1972.
That's amazing. A long time after Bascom. And was that part of the reason that he left Williams, his frustration over various reforms?
That and the fact that he was in a close contest to become the successor to Mark Hopkins as president. He had the faculty entirely behind him, but Mark Hopkins was an autocrat. He virtually felt the school was his. The reason he didn't want Bascom in there, he had much respect for him, for sure. But Bascom had gone too liberal. This would not be good for the school. There was still the old orthodoxy there, well represented on the Board of Trustees.
When
and
you
so
say
on.
Liberal, you mean in terms of ideas about labor and class or women's issues or temperance?
Yeah, I'll try to make that distinction. Those would be liberal, progressive, social issues. But in terms of liberal theology—
Oh, so his religious beliefs.
It was his religious beliefs. And the clear way he had gone away from Orthodox Calvinism, anti-Calvinism.
You also mentioned in the book that Bascom really embraced Darwin and evolution.
Yes, indeed.
Did that play a role also in the way his religion changed?
Very much so, yes. Bascom was not alone here. Most of the liberal thinkers saw in evolution a new scheme for explaining God's dealing with the world, God's presence in the world, God's treatment of human beings. But in Bascom's case, evolution gave him, it fortified his feelings already against any notion of truth as permanent, as fixed, as locked eternally into some summarized code or so on. He regretted that churches used dogma and confessions of faith because he said, our understanding of the world is always changing, and it changes mostly because of science. And this is the largest failing of the church, is not to follow the world of science, to learn from it. Evolution is the most recent case in point. And especially for Bascom, what he liked about this model of science is that it showed that change, impermanence, flux are the realities of things. No species is locked in place. Nothing is permanent. You know, that's a huge theological issue if we go back to Genesis and how God created the world. But that wasn't important for him. Don't look to Genesis. Look to what science tells you. And religious people in the churches should be open-minded about accommodating these new views of the universe.
So if Bascom opposed slavery, he was in favor of women's rights. He was progressive in many ways in terms of his ideas about labor and class. What kind of blind spots did he have? If you look back at all his writing, and I know you have done so, he wrote a lot. Do you find places where you see that he was in some ways narrow-minded or a product of his time in his thinking, either about race Wow. or class or other things, where you see limitations in his views?
Well, I like Bascom very much. One of the reviewers of the manuscript felt I liked him a bit too much and should exercise a more critical judgment.
That's what a reviewer said about my book about Jane Austen.
There you go.
It's hard not to like what you're writing about.
Well, you know, Arthur Schlesinger, a famous historian of the Kennedys, you know, was always said, you're biased, you're pro-Kennedy. So I said, well, sympathy is also a means of critical understanding as well as aversion to what someone thinks. I think Bascom's method often got in the way of his effectiveness. He was really dogmatic in a way his intellectual system discouraged that. Temperance is the big issue, of course.
When you say he was dogmatic, you mean that
That he was inflexible.
That he had an opinion and did not want to bend to someone else's.
Only on this issue.
Just on temperance.
Almost everything else, he is really just ready to learn. But on this,
because you do find some in the, you know, late 1800s, like Bascom, who will seem to be ahead of their times in some ways if embracing racial equality, yet make comments that make us cringe now. And
yeah,
same with women.
Try to be attentive to those. You know, I gave a talk about Bascom in light of a book recently published about the progressives and their view of race and eugenics. And it's not a good record. Some of the people in this book, Richard T. Ely and Charles Van Hise and John R. Commons especially, have very unwelcoming and, to us, very blameworthy views of race and their Anglo-Saxon pride and sense of superiority. Bascom never went that way. He didn't talk about race much, but I'll give you two instances. There was enough talk at this time. This really flourished in the early 20th century, the eugenics movement and the fashion for eugenics. But Bascom, still in the middle 19th century, was in the midst of all kinds of Anglo-Saxon ideas. These were not new then. He didn't like them. And he said, this is not the way by which we should judge the world. He did at one point, or maybe two, say the Anglo-Saxons have accomplished much. Other races can learn from the way they've perfected their political systems. And in the question of Reconstruction, where the whole race issue flourished again once slavery was abolished in 1865, the whole question of what does one do with the former slaves, we had the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Bascom didn't like to talk about the argument against those amendments, saying this is a white person's country, only whites are capable of appreciating and exercising democratic governments. They said this kind of essentialism race has nothing to do with it. Race inherent has nothing to do with it. If anything, they're... You know, I actually wrote three different endings to this book before we finally settled on. And I did take up this question of race and eugenics and the progressive era. But I backed off and said, this book is about John Bascom, first and foremost. So I won't do everything under the sun that I could do.
And it sounds like he was more ahead of his time than his peers in many ways.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the feminists of the day did not support divorce legislation. John Bascom did. Many felt, you give these men the right just to divorce at will or under any protection of the law, they're going to abandon their families. They'll walk. Many of the feminists were not that concerned about the suffrage. And there was some division there, too. But Bascom said this is essential. And I don't know. I often ask my audiences, how many women of the day were lamenting the dress codes in place for women in the way that Bascom was?
So he was further along than many of them.
Yeah, I think he had insights.
Maybe it was those strong sisters and strong daughters. And that was, I think one of his daughters you mentioned went on to earn one of the first PhDs in geology in the country.
So she did.
We're going to travel with John Bascom to Madison, where he takes on the job of president, when we return in a moment with University of the Year. A figure tall, erect, and strong, a face at once massive and mobile, a curt, incisive, and direct address, a mind powerful far beyond the ordinary measure, a dominating personality. Those are the words of Dean Burge about John Bascom, president of the University of Wisconsin, starting in 1874. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, David Hoveler, the author of John Bascom and the Origins of the Wisconsin Idea, published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2016. So John Bascom, this liberal Protestant with lots of ideas about society, including women's rights, temperance, and workers' rights, arrives in Madison. Tell us what happens when he takes over as president of this university and what he found here. What are we talking about when we say University of Wisconsin in 1874?
American higher education is in an age of transition. The old-time college had a standard curriculum, had modest offerings. But increasingly, there were students from these institutions who wanted to do more. They wanted to expand knowledge. They wanted to take their studies and what they would do today to graduate schools, but we didn't have any. Many of these ideas were coming from Germany, where our students went because there was no place else to go, and Germany was just world-renowned for its excellent research universities. So this became part of a generation that was determined to transform our universities by making them centers of research, investigation, and exploration, and the discovery of new knowledge, not just passing on an acquired body of knowledge, but exploring the world where it needed exploration. Now, John Bascom did not himself go to Germany, but he was much influenced by German philosophical idealism. It's another one of the three major components with liberal Christianity and evolution in his intellectual makeup. In his reports to the trustees, and he gave annual accounts of where the university was going and where it stood while he was president, he did often address this issue. He felt that professors taught too much. They were required even to teach in different subjects. This is not the way to make the marks of a university that will be recognized for the work it does and in scholarship and in advancing knowledge. It's not the way to go at all. He wanted them, therefore, to be experts in their field and have the time to do work that would find its way back into the classroom. There would be no conflict between research and teaching. In fact, teaching would be much better, be much more interesting, and students would find it much more exciting that way. Now, Bascom had the support of the regents to some extent, but he had trouble right away. First, there was not that sense among them of the university existing for those purposes. They saw John Bascom just really as a kind of an administrator. You know, he had no office staff. He had to address commencement invitations by hand himself. He had no real intellectual independence insofar as neither he nor any of the faculty could assign a textbook without the approval of the regents. So this was dysfunctional, he felt. He didn't always change it. And when matters got worse politically, and they got worse politically because of his strong stance on temperance, then we come to a kind of an impasse.
When we're talking about temperance, and of course Wisconsin having a heavy German component, a lot of breweries, a lot of emphasis on drinking, with Bascom's passion about this issue, and you linked it to women's rights, was that this notion that men who were drinkers tended to waste money and be abusive to the women? Is that why there was that close link?
Sure. Men lost their jobs. Men worked hard in industrial America. It was not an easy life. They stopped at the saloons on the way back. Women were at home taking care of one, two, or three children. Their resentment grew. Bascom was sympathetic to this, as he was sympathetic to the laborers who were caught in that ordeal themselves. But the two causes were important in that way. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, led by Frances Willard, began as a temperance organization. But she's recognized we're not going to get anywhere in temperance until we have the votes to rule it out. And therefore, it joined the suffrage cause as well.
But wouldn't there have been some sort of separation between John Bascom's role as president of a university and then these political views?
The regents sure thought so. They admonished him rather severely and said, well, we respect your opinion, but you are the president of the state university. You are a head of the public university of this state, and it represents a lot of people. Bascom sort of defended himself, but I think he took it to heart, too. He backed off a bit on some of these commitments, and he declined to hold offices in the statewide temperance organization, for example. But Emma Bascom was there, and he worked with her, too.
You include in your book some comments that Bascom made about women that include— let me just find one of them. But at the time that he started as president of the UW, was it coeducational?
It was always coeducational.
Mm-hmm. But they were put in different classes?
Yes. The issue was separate curriculum. And the record goes back and forth on that. Paul Chadbourne, who preceded Bascom by one person, didn't like coeducation at all. And he was not even prepared to accept the invitation that the regents offered him to be president of the UW until he could get this matter cleared up. So they went to the separate curriculum. But just before Bascom arrived here, and just at the time of his appointment, the regents went back to a unified curriculum called the Universal Curriculum. Bascom's point over and over again was, there's no inherent difference. There is no essential way by which men and women are different intellectually, mentally, and so on. that would preclude their studying together and having a curriculum together that they shared in the classroom.
You write in your book that Bascom writes, "It will hardly be denied that women manifestly have the powers that would enable them to enter on a wider activity than now falls to them, and that that activity in turn would rapidly widen the powers which by their very presence are leading women to seek a field for their exercise." But you also include the statement of the Board of Regents that suggested that it could harm the health of women if they took, you know, mathematics and some of the tougher classes. Better that the future mothers of the state should be robust, hardy, healthy women than that by overstudy they entail upon their descendants the germs of disease.
Oh, this is a big issue. That actually came from a board of visitors who came to look at this question of coeducation and how was it affecting the student at the university, especially the women, of course. And they reported that they were concerned about a condition of, quote, bloodlessness among the females. Well, you know what we're referring to here. Edward Clark, a Harvard medical physician, had written a book in the early 1870s about sex and education, the title of the book. He didn't make the case that men and women were unequal in terms of their mental abilities, but he did stress the point that intellectual activity, and especially hard mental work, had a serious physiological toll on young women, particularly at the age of their studying at college. Oh, boy. This was taken up by other feminists. Bascom actually contributed to an anthology of essays, all designed to refute this point. Julia Ward Howe, famous for the Battle Hymn of the Republic, of course, was the editor of this book. And there were about 11 women contributors and two men, and one was John Bascom, refusing to accept this as any serious impediment. He said, we don't know enough about it. It should not be used as an excuse to perpetuate the system that we've had too long of separate curriculum or denying women access to higher education altogether.
I heard that there's an irony on this, the UW-Madison campus, where the first coeducational dorm, Chadburn Hall, was named after someone opposed to having women here at all. So there's something kind of nice.
Chadburn, too, by the way, was the person who beat out Bascom for the presidency at Williams to succeed Mark Hopkins. So the kind of irony there, too. But anyway, he was much happier here.
So as president of the UW-Madison, well, at that point, it was the only University of Wisconsin. As president, what difference did John Bascom make? He arrived here. The university was a certain way.
Yeah.
He had to work with the legislature. Yeah. He said he had to get the courses approved. It was not really a academic freedom in a certain way for the coursework. It was that they had to get approval there. What difference did it make that John Bascom was in that office?
You know, John Bascom did not fully realize the university he would like to have had at Madison. The transformation to a research-oriented institution was gradual. It did not occur even by the time he left in 1887. He was pleased to have a brand-new science building that came as the second one and still stands down here the year he left. But he left the university that was too politically charged for him. So in terms of what difference it made, or he made as president, it's really in the successors that came after him. And I conclude with the chapter called The Wisconsin Idea, which deals with those who were his students, who conscientiously took note of the university ideals that he championed and had a chance to put them in place themselves.
And before we get to discussing the Wisconsin idea, what that is, what it became, and so on, let's go back to Bascom's other area that you talked about besides women's issues and temperance, and that was labor. Yes. And workers' rights. First of all, what were his views on it, and how did that matter at a state university?
Yeah. You know, I should preface this by saying that all three of the reforms in which he was engaged do come out of his way of looking at reality itself and the way he took up questions in philosophy and theology and applied them. And especially when evolution came into vogue and we saw how he embraced it, now he could offer for his social reform programs the ideal of the organic society, society which is itself an organism, like a live individual human being, that must have all its parts and its components working together. If one component is not healthy and doing what it is meant to do, the organism suffers itself. This was a model which he could see in evolution or biology and apply to society as a whole. It had great consequences in its thinking because, to carry the analogy further, an organism also has a brain. It has mental functions. In the Darwinian mode, it has to find means of adapting and surviving, meeting the challenges of a changing environment. This was the role of the state. And the state needed data, intelligence, as it were. It needed the knowledge that would enable the adaptations to be successful. This is why he emphasized the public so much. Now, when he looked at the situation of women, and this answers the question, why would he be concerned with how women dressed? He said, they're not functioning in the larger life of the community and its workforce and so on with these impediments. You had the word empower there, I believe, in that quotation. Bascom used this over and over again. And this is a role that the state can have, to look at where there is displacement, where there is prejudice, and where there are people who don't live to their potential. This is a role the state should have in bringing them into the fold. So if we go from the reforms for women to the reforms for labor, his view was the same thing. We have too many people who are trapped in horrible conditions and tenements and locked in poverty, don't have access to schools. There is little way by which this social organism can be successful with so much that is dysfunctional and out of place in terms of the functioning of the larger community and society.
I'm wondering, why didn't Bascom go into politics the way Bob La Follette did or others who kind of wanted to change the social organism? Because you're talking about the state and how things should be changed. Mm-hmm. Why didn't he consider politics?
Well, as I said, he tried law. And he liked the cerebral side of law. He liked studying jurisprudence and philosophy of law. He hated courtroom practice and the antagonisms of it. I would speculate that he probably didn't like the mud and muck of the political arena either. He was political. He gave political talks. He served on organizations.
And it almost sounds as if he's trying to use his position as president of a university as a bully pulpit for his own agenda.
I think that he felt that gave him as good a chance as any to get his message out.
And in terms of what he thought should happen to improve the conditions of workers and to alleviate poverty, he wasn't a socialist per se.
No, he certainly was not.
So what did he think should be done differently than it was in the late 1800s?
Well, the biggest problem he was confronted with, and this again goes back to his years at Williams when he published a series in the religious journal Bibliotheca Sacra and introduced his ideas on sociology, is the huge disparities of wealth in the United States. This is a familiar aspect of the Gilded Age. It's the age of Rockefellers and Morgans.
It's the age of now. I would add.
Some people refer to the second Gilded Age mm-hmm. that we are is in our midst. But money is power. And too much concentration of wealth in terms of individual hands or too much concentration of wealth in terms of corporations and trusts is an imbalance. It tips the scales. It makes the organization, the organism, not whole, not integrated. Harmony is the words he used over and over again, not in terms of the cosmos only, but in terms of what are the markings of a healthy, functioning, useful society and the role of government in bringing these things together. So income tax reform, we didn't have income taxes, but that was a place to start, a progressive income tax. Public control of major utilities, railroads, coal, and steel. All of these became part of the progressive agenda very soon after Bascom left Wisconsin.
What about access to education? In other words, at the time that he was there as president, could youth coming off a farm with no money attend the university?
Robert LaFalle is a good example. He had lost his father. His mother was married to a man whom Robert LaFalle had hated and kind of hated him, too. They really had no money. But he was an enterprising student, and he got here, and he taught a little bit while he was a student here and had enough money to buy the university, the student newspaper, and went out and got a lot of advertising for it and did pretty well. But he could get in without a lot of money. He did need some, of course.
And was that something that was important to Bascom, is that the student body reflect the diversity of income?
I don't think he talked about it very much, but insofar as it represented the state, and he always used the state as an ideal that he wanted his students to look up to and have an education that would lead them into service to the state. Yes, it should be inclusive in that respect as well.
We're going to talk about the Wisconsin idea when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. The guiding spirit of my time and the man to whom Wisconsin owes a greater debt than it can ever pay was its president, John Bascom. Bascom was the embodiment of moral force and moral enthusiasm, and he was in advance of his time in feeling the new social forces and in emphasizing the new social responsibilities. Bascom was forever telling us what the state was doing for us and urging our return obligation not to use our education wholly for our own selfish benefit, but to return some service to the state. Those are the words of Bob LaFollette about John Bascom. I'm Emily Auerbach. I'm back with David Hovler, the author of John Bascom and the Origins of the Wisconsin Idea. Well, we all know Bob LaFollette and his progressive ideals. And obviously he's seeing Bascom as kind of his guiding light, which is interesting.
Yes.
Tell us about this phrase, Wisconsin Idea. We kind of have grown up with that. It has a national fame. It's not just here in the state.
Yes, indeed.
What does it mean, and how does Bascom have anything to do with it?
This is a complex phenomenon, but I would just try to give the essential outline of it by way of saying that two people, one of whom you introduced to us, Robert LaFollette, but also his classmate and good friend for most of their lives, Charles Richard Van Hise. We have Van Hise Hall, tallest mm-hmm. building on campus here. Were products of Bascom's tutelage, both from the class of 1879. So what was made available to them and many others was an intellectual outline and view of life with the attending reform applications that Bascom made from that larger view. And then for them, as they matured and took prominent roles in state university and in state government, to put them into place. And essentially, there are three components to the Wisconsin idea. The idea of the state university in service to the whole life of the state and the geographical boundaries of the state as a public institution. Second, as developed in these years, the role of faculty and the resources of the university in connection with the functioning of the state in terms of its government. The prime example was Charles McCarthy's Legislative Reference Library, a repository for studies done by the faculty in their research. This is the way Bascom wanted them to go, to be experts in certain fields, in their fields. A repository of data, investigations, whatever is useful in making intelligent policy decisions and intelligent and useful legislation. And the third component really is the idea of academic freedom. But not just that. What I want to do in this book, more than anything else, is ask the question and try to answer it. What does the Wisconsin idea look like from the vantage of John Bascom? We're now into the succession to that in terms of his students, as I mentioned. But the third component is academic freedom. But academic freedom is really, in a way, secondary to Bascom's idea about the human mind, its capacities, its outreach, its immense powers. We haven't talked much, and it's complicated to do so, about his philosophical engagements. But I will just say this. In terms of philosophy, in terms of his philosophical idealism, which he got from Germany, as opposed to the skepticism of David Hume and others, that's one area. Another area is idealism against positivism and the restricting of acceptable knowledge, only what the sense faculties give us and no speculation about anything beyond sensory knowledge. And then liberal religion, too, and Calvinism and how religion should accommodate itself to all the new explorations and discoveries of science. Bascom always stood on the side of the system that gave the endorsement to the capacities of human thinking. But he had a practical dimension, too, because he said, now we are in an age in which the public and government needs this knowledge. It's a different, more challenging age. This is where the universities come in. They make available this, and they make it available to the state, so the state will have an intelligent application of that knowledge. But the universities can give us this knowledge, and their professors can do their work effectively to secure that end only if they are untrammeled in their pursuit of their fields. Otherwise, you don't get good data. You get something that is forced.
And so, that's where you get things like the plaque about the fearless sifting and winnowing.
Absolutely. A classic case. I know this was the Richard T. Ely trial, as it were. He was a social gospeler. I mean, he was emphatically a Protestant liberal like Bascom was. Many didn't like his closeness to socialism, and they wanted him off the faculty. And the Board of Regents did itself proud. And the whole nation took note of this trial because Ely was a recognizable national figure. So the outcome registered in a profound way, and Wisconsin should be proud of it.
In defending the right of a faculty member to have views that were unpopular or controversial?
That's what this case was about, yes. And whether you would yield to the public pressure and censor or terminate a professor whose views were judged to be antithetical to the ideals of the people in the state, or a component thereof.
So with the Wisconsin idea, which I've always thought, kind of going along with what Charles Van Hise said in, I think, 1904, about the boundaries of the university being the boundaries of the state, that basically the wealth of knowledge, the resources of the university were open to anyone in the state, not just the elite or not just the people sitting around the classrooms. Was that idea something that you see Bascom as sort of beginning the discussion of, that then Van Hise and others got the credit for?
Yeah. People don't know about John Bascom's role. They may know a little bit more about his influence on Robert La Follette, because La Follette was more public about it, but Van Hise was just as appreciative in his own way. So that connection has gotten Bascom some notice. But in terms of how Bascom was poised to influence La Follette, and La Follette, you know, was not a bright student. He didn't care much for academics, except he loved Bascom's courses. That was the one exception. So we have a situation where La Follette could take a kind of residual message that comes out of a lot of complex thinking and philosophical engagement on the part of his instructor, John Bascom, and take the labels, as it were, service to the state. One point especially, La Follette's progressivism began in his efforts to undo the power of big moneyed interests. That's Bascom. You could ask La Follette about liberal Christian theology, and he probably wouldn't say a thing. He wouldn't know anything about it. Van Hise, likewise, was a very secular person. He didn't share any of Bascom's large religious view of things. But he did appreciate how Bascom was attentive to science. Van Hise was a geologist. And how he wanted to transform the university. But he also said something else, too, in one of the quotations here. That was his commitment to the moral side of every issue.
So it would be fair to say that Bascom, his view of the university was that it should be a force for good, that it should reach the state as a whole, that it should involve the pursuit of truth.
Absolutely. That above all.
And that it should make itself part of the social fabric and the kind of evolution of the state into something better.
Yes.
I noticed that in one review of your book, the reviewer mentioned the kind of recent, just a few years ago, controversy at taking out wording having to do with the Wisconsin idea. Can you talk about that a little bit? And do you think Bascom would have rolled over in his grave?
Bascom would have been proud, first of all, to see that the state legislature in 1973 inscribed into the state statutes essentially the ideas of the Wisconsin idea, including the pursuit of truth, but emphasizing also that that pursuit occurs along many roads, in the social sciences, the natural sciences, and the professional studies and so on, and technology as well. But the most important thing is the pursuit of truth. While the effort more recently was to get that out of there, I still haven't figured out why it was very offensive. Defense was, well, it's in the statutes. It ought to be out in the university's literature, not in the state statute. But there's more to it than that. There's an animosity against the university that has become very dangerous.
Well,
and this is one manifestation of it.
It's certainly something that Bascom experienced himself.
Yes,
and
he did.
Ended his tenure here as president of the University of Wisconsin. My guest has been David Hoveler, the book John Bascom and the Origins of the Wisconsin Idea. Thank you for joining me. I'm going to see Bascom Hall and Bascom Hill differently from now on.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me here
today. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.